Thank you, Liujun. Before starting my talk, let me just mention that Liujun requested me to give this talk, and it might be familiar to the people in Perimeter because this is based on the work that I did in Perimeter itself. So it might be a bit of repetition for them, but for the new people, I hope they will find it interesting. So I'm going to talk about this topic, controlled access to low energy physics of critical Fermi surfaces. I will start with some very introductory things and give you some non-technical details. And then for people who are interested in the more technical details, I will also try to cover that. So first of all, we are condensed matter physicists, and our job is to study a system which involves the complex behavior of a large number of interacting particles. And the main surprise is that the collective behavior gives rise to emergent properties which were not present if you had considered the individual particles themselves. In particular, I'm interested in strongly correlated systems, and let us briefly review what we mean by that. For example, if you just take a box of gas molecules, we know that they are weakly interacting. That means if you pick one gas molecule, the motion of its motion hardly depends on the position or motion of others. But then let us say we are lowering the temperature, and then the motions of these molecules get more and more correlated, and we see that there is an increase in complexity of the system. And we know that below certain temperature, there is the formation of the crystal. And in some way, it is also the emergence of a strongly correlated system. It shows different properties, for example, which are the excitations of this complex system. One very good example would be the phonon, which is the collective motion of many atoms or molecules that are present in the crystal. But now, how do we deal about this system as theorists? One of our strategies is to try to write down an effective field theory. As we already know that mostly we are interested in electrons because those are the mobile ingredients of a condensed matter system. And in a strongly correlated system, the position and motion of each electron is correlated with those of all the others. And therefore, to start with, the system seems hard to describe. Now, you might think that we might just put the equations in a computer and solve it by brute force, but this will not work because of the sheer large number of particles that we have to deal with. For example, the number or the density of electrons in the system will be of the order of Avogadro number. So this approach will not quite work, but we can then devise another approach, which will be to understand the long wavelength or the macroscopic properties of the system using a low energy or infrared effective field theory. This just means that we are looking at the long wavelength properties where the short distance information averages out. And in this situation, sometimes the microscopic details of the system become irrelevant. So a lot of systems which are microscopically different, they might give you the same long wavelength behavior. So this is the essence of writing the effective field theory, which helps us to identify universality classes for apparently different systems, but which have the same universality features. And sometimes this effective field theory are much simpler than the original microscopic models, which involve a lot of ingredients. And in this way, we can extract some properties which we can also relate to experimental observations. Okay, so in this talk, I will focus on non-Fermi liquids. But for that, let us just review what we mean by normal Fermi liquids or what the Landau Fermi liquids give us. The Landau Fermi liquids is actually an effective theory which can describe normal metals very well. So in the 1950s, Landau observed that if you take a finite density of weakly interacting fermions or electrons, it does not depend on the specific microscopic details of the system that you might choose to study. So there are largely two properties. One is the ground state, which is characterized by a sharp Fermi surface in the momentum space. Like for a 3D system, we have a sphere. For a 3D isotropic system, we have a spherical Fermi surface. And above that Fermi surface, you have the excitations, so the low energy excitations, which we call the quasi-particles. And we know that the Fermi surface is nothing but the boundary between the occupied and the unoccupied states in the momentum space for a free electron gas at zero temperature. Now, for a free electron gas, what are the elementary excitations? The excitations can be electrons and holes, where you take an electron from the filled Fermi sea and put it outside. And this will give you the excitation energy, which is the difference between the kinetic energy and the Fermi energy, where the Fermi energy is the energy that is defined right on the Fermi surface. Now, if you take conduction electrons in an actual material, then it will not be a free Fermi gas, but it will be an interacting Fermi liquid. Nevertheless, it has an excitation spectrum, which is very much similar to that of a free Fermi gas. So we can imagine it in the following way, that as we are slowly switching on electron-electron interaction, it is as if these excited electrons are getting dressed by the surrounding distortion. This is to take into account the interaction effects. And in this way, the quasi-particles emerge, which are the excitations of this interacting Fermi liquid. So basically, quasi-particles are the emergent entities in a Fermi liquid. So you can compute its behavior with the help of a perturbation theory. And these are the collective low energy quantum oscillations. Now, the good thing is that we can immediately write down a Green's function to describe the behavior of this system. So this Green's function is written in the energy momentum space, which is just the Fourier transform of the real space retarded Green's function, which gives us the probability amplitude for a quasi particle to propagate from point X to point Y. Now this Green's function has this variables omega, which is the energy, or the energy with respect to the Fermi surface energy EF. And it also has this K perpendicular momentum, which again measures the difference in magnitude from the perpendicular momentum with respect to the Fermi momentum. Now we also see that there are two parameters appearing in this Green's function. One is the gamma and one is the Z. So the gamma is nothing but the decay rate, and it is proportional to the energy square or the omega square. This means that if we move closer and closer to the Fermi surface, then the quasi particles become very much long lived and its lifetime diverges. Then there is the second parameter, Z, which is the quasi particle weight. This just tells us that how much overlap this interacting system has with the free fermion system. This is possible to compute because the two systems can be adiabatically connected with each other. Okay, but then when can we call a system to be a Fermi liquid? We can derive the Landau's Fermi liquid theory from a given interacting Hamiltonian by applying the many-body perturbation theory, which I showed you in a cartoon-like manner in the previous slide. But what we need is that the quasi-particle weight, the Z, that should not go to zero to get well-defined quasi-particles. And also the gamma, which is the width of the spectral distribution of the quasi-particle, that should be much less than the typical energy of the quasi-particle, such that the quasi-particles do not decay before establishing their excitation energy. We can see this more clearly from this graphs, where I have drawn the spectral distribution first for a free system, where you're supposed to get a delta function for the free electron spectral peak, and it has a weight 1. But as soon as you switch on the interactions, then this delta function becomes a Lorentzian, like you see here. And the quasi-particle weight is also reduced from the value 1. So this is the Z, which is typically less than 1. And the rest of the weight is shared by some background incoherent excitations. So the background excitations now have a weight of 1 minus Z. So this is when we can call that the system behaves as a proper Fermi liquid. Now, so quantitatively, we see that the Fermi liquid theory allows a perturbative treatment due to a weak effective interaction, where we have an exact part, which is like the free fermion part, and then you have the perturbative part, which you can which you can compute order by what order. And we also have claimed that there is a one-to-one correspondence with the free fermion system excitation for this quasi-particles. Now, basically, when you do all these things, it turns out that the quasi-particle energy should, of course, depend on the surrounding quasi-particle configuration, but nevertheless, they can be described by some renormalized parameters. I mean, the relations that we have remains the same as for a free fermion system, but you have to renormalize the parameters. For example, for the free fermion system, if you had the mass parameter m, now it will get changed to some other value, m star, but still the energy will be k squared by 2m kind of, but now you use m star instead of m. Similarly, the Fermi velocity gets modified from Vf to Vf star, and so on and so forth. Now, if you compute the temperature dependence of various thermodynamic and transport properties, they are also similar to that for that of a free fermion. Again, the parameters, the proportionality constants will be different, but the overall behavior will be the same. Like if you compute the specific heat, it will go as proportional to T. If you compute the resistivity, it will go as T square, and the susceptibility will not depend on the temperature T. So basically, we see that what seemed to be a complicated problem to start with has been reduced to a simpler one thanks to Landau's Fermi liquid theory. But then we also want to ask that how can we treat the interactions in an electron system in such a way, and why Fermi liquid theory gives such good results? Because we know that Coulomb interaction is one of the interactions that is present in a system. Well, let us see what is the reason for that. We know that there is screening effect, which is effectively reducing the electron-electron interaction. So due to electron-electron repulsion, it reduces the effective negative charge around each. So although the bare Coulomb interaction is like E squared by R, due to the screening, it gets damped by a factor, exponentially damping factor, which is this e to the power minus alpha R. So this is one reason. And the second reason is that we know that electrons being fermions, we should apply the Pauli exclusion principle, which also helps to reduce the many-body effects. Like if you want to compute electron-electron scattering, then the phase space for low energy scatterings is very much limited. Like suppose we have a field Fermi C or a Fermi C which is at a temperature T, then the excitations are more or less within this band of KBT. And the electrons which are scattering with each other should be within this band, and that restricts the possibility of where the scattering events can happen. And of course, you can understand that this argument is not restricted to weak interaction. So in many situations, in many conventional metals, the electron-electron interactions can indeed be considered as a perturbation. Okay, so now, the experimentalists have observed that there are peculiar behavior in some systems, some metallic phases, which cannot be quite captured by this Landau's Fermi liquid theory. And that, then we say that there is a breakdown of the Fermi liquid theory. And where such scenarios can happen? This typically happens when you have electrons interacting with bosons and you try to write down a low energy quantum field theory. Now, if it is a massive boson, then we get the usual picture of a conventional Fermi liquid theory with long-lived quasi-particles, etc. But in some systems where the boson becomes massless, then it can happen that the quasi-particles get destroyed, and then we call those systems as non-Fermi liquid systems. Now let us see some examples where such scenarios can appear. Now you can get a massless boson by dynamical tuning. For example, when you get emergent gauge bosons in different settings, like the fractional quantum Hall effect or for Bose metals. In these cases, you have non-Fermi liquid phases in extended regions of the parameter space. On the other hand, you can also get massless bosons by fine-tuning the microscopic parameters of the system. In such a situation, an otherwise massive boson becomes massless at a particular point of the value of the parameter. So these typically appear at the quantum critical points. So then we have a non-Fermi liquid phase at a quantum critical point. And this is the scenario that I'm going to focus on in this talk. Okay, so I will talk about critical Fermi surfaces, and let me explain to you what that means. So we want to ask the question that are there states where we have a sharp Fermi surface, but no existence of Landau quasi particles. That means for a good Landau Fermi liquid theory, I told you that you can write the Green's function in this fashion. But since if the quasi particles get destroyed, it means that the quasi particle weight is zero and you can no longer write the Green's function in this fashion. For d equal to one, a very well-known example is the Luttinger liquid, but then there is no Fermi surface as such, there are Fermi points. So let us look at d greater than one, where I already told you there are these examples of quantum critical points, which might be associated with the onset of some kind of ordering in the system, like antiferromagnetic order, pneumatic order, and so on. Or it might also be associated with some emergent gauge fields. So we'll discuss this scenario in this talk. Okay, so now, how can it happen that this quasi-particle weight goes to zero, or how is this quasi-particle getting destroyed, but nevertheless, we can identify a sharp Fermi surface. So let us see how that can happen in a particular example. So this is happening when the quasi-particle weight C is vanishing continuously everywhere on a Fermi surface. So here in the series of pictures, the ground state momentum distribution has been plotted as a function of the momentum K. So in the first picture, we have a phase where you have a proper interacting Landau Fermi liquid. You see that the N of K, or the ground state momentum distribution, undergoes a discontinuity at a particular momentum, which we call Kf, or the Fermi momentum. So this is how we identify the presence of the Fermi surface. And the discontinuity value is exactly equal to the quasi-particle weight Z. So this, the value of Z lies between 0 and 1. When you have 1, there is no interaction and it's a free Fermi liquid. Now let us imagine that this system goes to another phase where this Fermi liquid has been completely destroyed and the Fermi surface no longer exists and the NK is smooth everywhere. So now there is no question of the presence of the Fermi surface and no question of identifying any Fermi momentum at all. But just imagine that when the first picture is changing into the second, so this is the third picture where the Z has just gone to zero. So this is the critical point where NK is continuous at Kf, but the discontinuity has been replaced by a King singularity. That means the derivative is discontinuous now. So still it allows us to identify the presence of the Fermi surface. But since Z has gone to zero, the quasi-particles no longer exist. So this is an example of how you might be able to get a critical Fermi surface state. Okay, so now I'm going to discuss about some systems where you have this Fermi surface with the interacting with the massless boson, and the massless boson is an order parameter. So this order parameter theory is also proposed by Landau, which tells us that such an order parameter can drive a phase transition from an ordered phase to a disordered phase or vice versa. So in this case, this is a perfect recipe for getting non-Fermi liquid physics because this fermion boson coupling becomes strong in particularly in lower dimensions like in 2D, even though you start with the value of the bare coupling, which is small enough, it will ultimately flow to a very strongly coupled value. So this is a scenario where the Z can go to zero because of the strong interaction between the fermion boson system and the quasi-particles get destroyed. So intuitively, we can think of it like this, that if as long as we are away from the quantum critical point, we have a Fermi surface, which is very calm like this. But then as we are approaching the quantum critical point, this Fermi surface has become undergoing strong fluctuations and it's behaving as a stormy or a violent sea. And this is what is happening, which is killing the quasi particle. So we'll attempt this kind of, to describe this kind of non-Fermi liquid phases as a Fermi surface interacting strongly with some gapless order parameter fluctuation. And if we want to write it in terms of Feynman diagrams, the scatterings of electrons, then these will be mediated by the propagator of this massless boson, like I have shown you here. Now, you might be wondering that where does this non-Fermi liquids appear at all in real systems? I mean, why should we be interested in this kind of things? Well, they typically appear whenever you have this kind of high TC cupret materials. So if we look at a typical phase diagram of a high TC cupret material, we see that the strange metal phase lies adjacent to the superconducting phase. And in fact, these two phases compete with each other until superconductivity wins below the temperature TC. Anyway, but we can see the signatures of this non-Fermi liquid phase, which originates from this quantum critical point. We can see its signature at finite temperatures, where the experimentalists can measure various physical quantities. So there, the power laws in these physical quantities are very much different from what you would compute or expect for a genuine Fermi liquid. So this tells us that these are the systems where you do not have this lambda quasi-particles. Now, this is a very nice experimental result by Casters et al. Where they measure the resistivity on this heavy fermion compound. So there are these orange regions and these blue regions. So for the orange region, the resistivity goes as T, linear in T, whereas for the blue region, it goes as T square. Now, if you compute the resistivity using the Fermi liquid theory, it goes as T square. So these blue regions are Fermi liquids, but these orange regions then are showing some kind of strange metal or non-Fermi liquid behavior. So this tells us that we indeed need to formulate some calculational framework beyond the Fermi liquid theory, but we have to be cautious that whenever we want to try to write down the quantum field theory of metals, it is harder than the well understood cases that we tend to read in our quantum field theory textbooks, because for condensed matter theorists, we have to deal with systems which have a lower amount of symmetry, and we have to keep this extensive number of gapless modes when we are writing down the low energy theories. Like you have already seen that we have this excitations about the Fermi surface, which are strongly interacting with the massless boson excitation. So both of these are gapless modes, which we need to consider in our effective theory, which we want to write down. Okay, so we succeeded a little bit in this direction theoretically. So we devised a controlled approximation to determine the critical scalings using the concept of dimensional regularization. So without going into the mathematical details, let me just first give you a very cartoon-like explanation of this. So suppose we are dealing with the Fermi surface of a 2D metal, and it is undergoing some violent fluctuations. So suppose we have a black dot here, and the probability of this black dot of getting hit by the fluctuations of the Fermi surface is very high in this situation. But now let us say we add some extra dimensions perpendicular to the Fermi surface, which are also called co-dimensions. Now this kind of setup immediately suppresses the quantum fluctuations. And why is that so? So suppose now we have the cylinder where we have added the extra dimension and we have still this Fermi line now in the 3D momentum space because we have gapped out the other parts of the cylinder. So now if you again consider this black dot, the Fermi line now can fluctuate in two perpendicular directions. So naturally the probability of this black dot of getting hit by the Fermi surface fluctuation is lower than in the original case. So this is kind of why adding extra dimensions helps us to suppress the quantum fluctuation. Anyway, so this is a very well-known tool from statistical mechanics or quantum field theory, where you add some extra dimension and find the upper critical dimension DC. Now, if you have a system where D is greater than DC, it can be described very well by the mean field theory. In this situation, it can be explained very well by the Fermi liquid theory. But if you are dealing with a system where the physical dimension is less than or equal to DC, then mean field theory will not give you the correct answers. So then you're dealing with a strongly coupled theory. But nevertheless, if the physical dimension is close to DC, then we can carry out a perturbative expansion in a parameter epsilon, which is the difference between DC and the physical dimension. So this is the theoretical tool we used But I will give you more technical details about this when I actually write down the action, etc. Okay, so using this tool, we examined quite a number of systems. The first one was the Ising pneumatic quantum critical point, where you have a quantum phase transition. So in the first phase, we have a Fermi surface, which has a Z4 symmetry, like the square symmetry. And the order parameter has zero expectation value. So this R is some tuning parameter, and this is the temperature along the y-axis. Now, if you go to the other phase, which is brought about by this order parameter, then the Fermi surface has a reduced symmetry. Now it has a Z2 symmetry, and the Fermi surface is elongated either in the vertical direction or in the horizontal direction. And in this case, the order parameter takes a non-zero expectation value. This order parameter here is called the Ising pneumatic order parameter. It is a real scalar boson, and right at the quantum critical point, it becomes massless. Now, it is argued that this Ising pneumatic order parameter appears in, again, certain high TC materials like cuprates, ruthenites, or nictites. And there's a cartoon where you can see this kind of order parameter phase transition appearing. Okay, now what are the results that we got? Basically, before us, Sangsik and Dennis considered this case for the 2D materials, but for me, we extended it to the case of 3D or in general for a generic Fermi surface. There we found that for a 3D material, which has a 2D Fermi surface, there is the appearance of ultraviolet infrared mixing, where the fluctuations of the Fermi surface are entangled with each other all over this 2D Fermi surface. We also saw a very curious thing that the answers were one loop exact, which just means that two loops and higher loop corrections vanish. Okay, but this is not the most experimentally interesting case. The experimentally interesting case is still the 2D material, which has a 1D Fermi surface. This 2D material undergoes even more violent fluctuation of the Fermi surface. But one thing is that the fluctuations are effectively local. There is no ultraviolet infrared mixing for the 2D case. I mean, the fluctuations are not entangled with each other over the entire Fermi surface. Okay, so this is the difference between 2D and 3D. And let me just focus on 2D for some more physical results, which we could relate to experiments, in fact. So we computed the optical conductivity in this strange metal regime and found that it goes as omega to the power minus 2/3, which is close to the value that was measured in some experiments on optimally doped cuprates. Now, I also computed the superconducting instability in such systems, and I found that this quantum critical point should always be masked by a superconducting dome. Okay, and we also applied the same framework to another system, which is the quantum phase transition between an FFLO phase and a normal metal phase, as you can see here. So along the vertical axis, we have some magnetic field, and the T temperature is along the horizontal axis. So here, as you increase the magnetic field, first it turns from a homogeneous superconductor to an FFLO superconductor, and finally, it goes to a normal metal phase. And in between, one can expect to see a non-Fermi liquid behavior emerging from this quantum critical point. Now, just to remind you what an FFLO phase means, that in general, if we have a BCS pairing, it's a pairing between two electrons which has momentum k and minus k. So overall, the pair has zero momentum. But for an FFLO pair, you have the pairing between two electrons where the momentum do not cancel, so that you get a Cooper pair with a finite momentum, which we call QFFLO. Now, this is not quite experimentally verified because I've heard that it's very difficult to get a clean system to get the clear signatures, but suppose one could do that, there is a possibility that you could see a potentially naked or unmasked quantum critical point in the systems, so that the scaling regime might be observable down to arbitrarily low temperatures. So for this system, we wrote down the effective field theory, I found the upper critical dimension, etc., and used this controlled perturbative expansion and computed the critical properties of a stable non-forming liquid for this system. There are other examples from my work. I considered recently Fermi surface with transverse gauge fields, but we had considered this topic earlier in other contexts. As I told you, we considered this Fermi surface with FFLO boson, and I also studied Fermi surface with the spin interacting with the spin density wave order parameter. Now let me give you the technical details for this particular system, which involves the asymptomatic quantum critical point. Okay, so first of all, let us try to set up the system. So what are the ingredients that we have? We will have a generic m-dimensional Fermi surface where m is greater than zero. So it starts from one and then it is generic. And then we consider a scalar boson, which is centered at zero momentum. That means the entire Fermi surface interacts with the scalar boson, unlike the FFLO case or unlike the SDW order parameter case, where particular points of the Fermi surface interacts with the scalar boson. Now, when we consider low energy limit of such a theory, the fermions will scatter mostly tangentially, because if they scatter perpendicular to the Fermi surface, it will cost it a lot of energy and no longer it will be the low energy limit. And then we assume time reversal invariance. That means if you are considering a right moving fermion, you must also consider its partner, which is on the antipodal point of the Fermi surface, which is the left moving fermion. So we consider this fermions in pairs on the two sides of the Fermi surface. But now let's first look at the 2D case, which has a one-dimensional Fermi surface. For example, the circular Fermi surface, which is m equal to one. So if m is the dimension of the Fermi surface, for a 2D material, the Fermi surface dimension m is equal to one. Now in this case,
So here, if you do not assume time reversal invariance, but just the inversion symmetry, what changes?
So if you don't have the time reversal symmetry, then you don't have to consider the left moving fermion at all, right?
But if you assume inversion symmetry.
So if you have an inversion symmetry, what partner do you have? Can you just tell me?
The other path with the opposite momentum.
Okay, so then in your effective action, you have to consider that partner, which gives you that particular thing. So in this theory, we have to consider the right moving and the left moving whenever you are considering the patches. You have to include both of this. But if you have some other symmetry, which relates this fermion with another, which might be located somewhere else in the Fermi surface, then those you have to include within your action. So you have to appropriately write down your effective theory, which includes these particular fermions.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so in this case, we have to consider both the right moving and the left moving fermions. So basically we are saying that since in the low energy limit, the fermions can scatter tangentially, the fermions in different patches are decoupled except at the antipodal points. So basically, if you draw tangent vectors for the Fermi surface, the points which have parallel tangent vectors, those points will interact with each other. And in this case, if we consider time reversal invariance, then these antipodal patches should interact with each other. And as Liujun asked, if we had some other kind of symmetry, which relate to some other points of the Fermi surface, then we should consider those things in our theory according to what system you are looking at. Now, this is the story for a 2D material with the 1D Fermi surface. Now, if we go to a higher dimension, which has a higher dimensional Fermi surface, for example, for a 3D material, it will have a 2D Fermi surface, which is for an isotropic material, it will be a sphere. Now this patch description will not then be true for this higher dimensional material, because any two points on the sphere can be connected by parallel tangent vectors. So they will have a common parallel tangent vector, no matter which two points you pick on the sphere. So an example of scattering for two points is shown in this second picture. So this patch description will not entirely be true for an m-dimensional Fermi surface when you have m greater than one. And when we started our calculation, the expectation was then that the size of the Fermi surface, which is encoded in this parameter kf, that should somehow enter into the physical quantities as a dimensionful parameter whenever you are looking at m greater than one. Okay, so let me just emphasize once more on this value of m and the significance of the value of m. So I already told you that the overall dimension of the system controls the strength of quantum fluctuations. That's why we resort to things like dimensional regularization. But this m here, the dimension of the Fermi surface, it also has a very important role in the sense that it controls the extensiveness of gapless modes. So it tells us that whether you can just concentrate on patches or you have to consider the effect of the entire Fermi surface. So as we saw, there is an emergent locality in momentum space for m equal to one, but not for m greater than one. So for m equal to one, we have some simplification in the sense that the observables are local in momentum space. So if you just compute the Green's function, for example, that can be just extracted from the local patches. So for this case, Tennis and Sangsik, they considered this 2+1 one-dimensional nematic quantum critical point, and they found that it can be described by a stable non-Fermi liquid state where the critical dimension is DC is 5½, and then they expand in the small parameter epsilon, which takes the value half in this case. But if you go to m greater than one, then there is non-trivial ultraviolet infrared mixing comes into play, which just means that the low energy physics which we are looking at is affected by gapless modes present on the entire Fermi surface. And somehow the size of the Fermi surface of the KF modifies Knipe scaling, which you would have just obtained based on patch description. Somehow KF becomes a naked scale whenever you're considering m greater than one. Okay, so now let me try to set up the action for which you have to set up the coordinate system, a convenient coordinate system. So we take a generic Fermi surface of dimension m as long as it is convex, and we take a particular point around which we set up the coordinate system. So at a chosen point k star, we set up the coordinate system. And then here, k d minus m is perpendicular to the local spherical Fermi surface. So this k d minus m has a magnitude, which is the deviation from the value of the Fermi momentum kf. Then the tangential directions are encoded in this vector lk, which can have many directions depending on what dimensional system you're considering. Okay, so now we said that we will consider time reversal invariant theory. So we will have a right moving fermion, which is psi plus, and a left moving fermion, which is psi minus. So we have to consider the point k star and its antipodal partner minus k star. And we also use an extra index j, which denotes the flavor of the fermion. But the theory does not depend on any large n expansion or anything. So n can take any value that applies for your system. So it is not necessary for any perturbative control. Now we will also use a two-component spinner, which includes the psi plus and the psi minus fermions in this fashion. So all these ingredients will be used in our action. Okay, now we are ready to write down the effective action. So we basically have two halves of the m-dimensional Fermi surface. So two halves, because we have k star and minus k star. And that should interact with the massless boson in m plus one space and one time dimension. So basically the system has an m-dimensional Fermi surface and there is one direction perpendicular to the Fermi surface. So that's why it's an m plus one dimensional in the spatial sense. Okay, so now let us write down the action. So there are these three parts of the action. The first part involves the fermions where we have the left and the right moving fermions. So S takes the value plus minus. And then we expand around that point where we erected our coordinate system. So that's why it looks like this. And then there are, of course, higher order terms depending on what the Fermi surface looks like globally. But these higher order terms are irrelevant in the RG sense. So you can just forget about them. So this, the first line is then just the kinetic part for the fermions. Now the second part is the kinetic part for the bosons. We said that we must have a massless boson, so there is no mass term. And the last part is the Yukawa-like coupling between the fermion and the boson. Okay, so this is our action to start with.
So suppose I consider a three-dimensional system with a 1D Fermi surface, namely a nodal line, then E is equal to 3, M is equal to 1, so D minus M is 2. So for this case, I have as KD minus M is K2. What happens to K1?
Okay, so basically in this action, only the term which is relevant is the LK square for the boson, as soon as the bosonic part is concerned. So you throw away the K0 square and KD minus square anyway in this particular setup. So though I wrote it here, we never considered this in our actual calculation. And for the fermion, then you will have another term in the kinetic energy, right?
Another term that is linear in K.
Yes, so that will be like IK0 plus whatever you have here. So basically, I think we are going to do that anyway when we do the dimensional regularization.
Okay. Thanks.
Right. I mean, here, of course, my aim is not to consider with a co-dimension 2 system, as you said. But anyway, we are going to do that just for the sake of mathematical, as a mathematical trick for the dimensional regularization. But that can also be applied for a real system as you're describing, where we actually have a co-dimension 2. Okay? Yeah, okay. So that was our original action. Now, we will just rewrite this original action in terms of this two-component fermion, psi plus and psi minus, that I told you about. So the reason for writing it is to bring it to a form where the fermion part of the the kinetic part of the fermions looks like that of a Dirac fermion. So now you see that I have rewritten the action of the previous page in terms of this two-component spinner, and it looks like this here. And if we interpret this mod of LK as a continuous flavor, each of this M plus 2D spinner can be viewed as if it were a 1 plus 1D Dirac fermion. So now we can use all the tools that we know from quantum field theory to this action, because we have massaged it into a form with which we are very much familiar with from our textbooks. Now, I told you that we were dropping these higher order terms, which depends on the curvature, on the global curvature of the Fermi surface. Now, that might create a trouble while you are doing loop integration, because in physically that is finite, but then if you just drop those terms, it will give you divergence, unphysical divergence in your integrals. So then what you could do, you could apply a hard cutoff, but that will be computationally hard. So we just applied a soft momentum cutoff in the form of this exponential. So I'll show this picture in a better way. So basically, we started with a compact Fermi surface, which was approximated by two sheets of non-compact Fermi surface centered at K star and minus K star. So if they're parabolic, like we kept the dispersion to be parabolic, that means if you do a momentum integral in this direction, it's going to diverge. But then that is not physically correct. That's why we have to include this exponential factor or this soft cutoff, which effectively makes the Fermi surface finite, which is the actual physical case, by damping out the large LK modes or the modes which are far away from the K star. So again, this is a mathematical trick. As I said, you could also apply a hard cutoff, but that might be just computationally more challenging. Okay, so that was the theory, that was the original theory, but now our aim is to find out the upper critical dimension. So we have to apply dimensional regularization by writing down the theory in generic dimensions. So we add some extra special dimensions which are perpendicular to the Fermi surface. We also call it co-dimensions. So we had this K0, but now we promote it to a vector K which has now many components. Like Liu Jun asked, what if we had an extra component? So basically, this will also include the theory that Liu Jun was asking about. So similarly, we have also to promote the gamma zero matrix now to a vector matrix, which has many components. The number of components should be the same as the vector capital K. And then we just use this notation that this gamma 1 times kt minus m plus lk square is written as gamma t minus m delta k, where delta k is this object. Okay, so now this is our theory in generic dimensions, where this term gamma dot k is the new term after we added the extra dimensions or the co-dimensions. And we will analyze this theory to find out the upper critical dimension and other things. Okay, so basically we are using dimension as a tuning parameter. Let me remind you once more that if the dimension of the system is less than the upper critical dimension DC, then the theory should flow to an interacting non-Fermi liquid at low energies. However, if the D is greater than DC, then it should be well described by mean field theory, and in this case, it's the Fermi liquid theory. Now, when we start our calculations, we want to choose some regularization scheme. And typically, when we do that in our relativistic QFT, we are very careful that we maintain locality in real space. And the choice of our scheme is consistent with as many symmetries as possible that the system originally had. Now, in our scheme, we have the advantage that we could maintain locality. This is to compare with other schemes that people have used earlier, like the scheme of Senthil and Shankar, where they modified the dispersion of the boson, but that would give rise to a non-local action in the real space. So then the locality was broken in their scheme. But we could avoid this situation in our setup. But we have the disadvantage that some symmetries got broken, in particular, the global U1. But that did not affect the final results of our calculation. Now, let me also point out the various energy scales or various momentum scales that are involved in the setup. So first of all, there is this Wilsonian cut of lambda. We usually use the symbol lambda to denote it, which is the implicit UV cutoff when we are doing the loop integrals for these various momentum components like capital K or the KD minus M. So all these momenta are perpendicular to the Fermi surface. Okay, so those must be less than the Wilsonian cutoff lambda. The Wilsonian cutoff lambda, on the other hand, should be much, much less than the Fermi momentum Kf, which is kind of the infinite scale in this problem. So the Kf scale sets the size of the Fermi surface, whereas lambda, it sets the largest momentum that the fermions can have perpendicular to the Fermi surface. And when we compute the RG flow, we sort of change lambda, and then we require that the low energy observables are independent of this lambda. And this is how we obtain the beta functions for the RG flows. Now, in this system, we have these two variables, M and D. M is the Fermi surface dimension, and D is the overall dimension of the system. So we fix or focus on a particular value of M and tune the value of D towards a critical value DC, at which the fermion self-energy diverges logarithmically in lambda. So we compute this one loop fermion self-energy. And as I told you, we can now access the non-Fermi liquid perturbatively in this parameter epsilon, which is the difference between DC and the physical dimension. And in the physical dimension in this case is just M plus one, because originally there was only one perpendicular direction to the Fermi surface. Okay, so what is the critical dimension value did we find by this calculation? Now, naively you would think, or which we learned from our relativistic quantum field theory courses, that the critical dimension is the point where the scaling dimension of the coupling constant vanishes. So if you do that, you get this value of the critical dimension. But the actual criteria, the true critical dimension, is always where the one loop fermion self-energy blows up logarithmically. So in general, in all the computations, these two definitions usually match. So this DC that we found was, of course, different from what you would find by the first criteria. So this DC is M plus 3 by m plus 1. So these two coincide at m equal to 1 and m equal to 2, but in the intermediate region, they are not quite equal. So we have to be careful that we use the actual critical dimension rather than the naive one. Okay, so after we found the critical dimension and we found the value of the expansion parameter, we also found out that the effective coupling is not the bare coupling, but it is some combination of the bare coupling and the parameter Kf. So here I have written Kf tilde because Kf tilde is Kf scaled by some mass scale mu. And this effective coupling, which is what remains small in loop expansion, and this controls the loop expansion. It's not the bare coupling which actually grows in this RG flows. So to find out the RG flow fixed points, we have to compute the beta function of this effective coupling, not the bare coupling. So we compute the beta function of this effective coupling, and the zeros of this beta function will give us the fixed points. Now, there is always the Gaussian fixed point, but we are not interested in this. We are interested in the interacting fixed point where the effective coupling has a non-zero value. And we found that at that fixed point, these are the values. The effective coupling takes this value n epsilon by some parameter u1. It has some number depending on what dimension you are looking at. And then you can also compute the various physical quantities like the dynamical critical exponent z and the anomalous dimensions for fermions and bosons. So these are the values that we obtained.
A question?
Yeah.
Here this E effective appears in the denominator of the beta function. Is this kind of unusual?
Well, I have written it in this way, but in principle, you can expand it in small E effective, right?
Usually you just get a result that is a polynomial of EEF, but here, how did you get it in the denominator?
Well, we just solved the various beta function equations. So you demand that the bare, the various things in the bare action are independent of the mu, and then you solve those equations, solve this coupled equation. So this is how we obtained it. But I agree with you that this is somewhat unusual for this system. In general, in QFT, you do not get it. But then how we interpret it, ultimately we would like to expand it in small e effective. At this point, like while computing things, we do not assume anything about e effective. We just solve it order by order in epsilon, right? The 1 over epsilon comes in your loop calculations. So that's why I'm saying order by order in epsilon. So you solve your equations by matching different powers of epsilon. You do not assume E effective is small or big or whatever. You just keep it as a parameter. Then we just get it. But at the end, we will like to have E effective small, and then we expand it. But from here, you already see that E effective is small, because if you solve this equation, it is of the order of epsilon. So everything is self-consistent.
Okay, thanks. So just a small technical detail. So here, suppose I want to solve this E effective fixed point, and I expand the denominator, then I will, it seems the fixed point value you show here is just by setting the numerator to be zero. If I expand the denominator, shouldn't I get some correction?
Okay, so I think in the next slide, I have expanded this and written it in this form, actually.
Uh-huh.
So basically, this is the form that you should get. I think if you solve this equation, it will give you this value, right? So that is the, that is the first order derivative that you set to zero. And then, I computed here to determine whether the fixed point is stable or not. Right, so let me just see. So if you solve this equation, you get the same answer, right? I'm a little bit confused now. Can someone confirm if you get the same answer as this one? So if we do this, we just take E effective common, right? And then what do we have here? Yeah, so then I have...
Oh, I see. The other term gives a correction that's of order epsilon squared.
Yeah. I think that's the point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So yeah, so you basically you get both the solutions that I showed you here. You get E effective equal to zero and the E effective equal to this one. Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful. It's a bit confusing. Like, I think it's not a good way to write it. Like when I redid this calculation recently, I didn't find it good to write it in this manner. I would prefer to write everything in terms of epsilon, and then might be it's a little bit less confusing, but there is nothing, no problem with this equation. That's all I want to say.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. The reason now I expand it in terms of E effective square, because the next question you would like to answer is that, well, we have found a fixed point, but is it stable? If it's not stable, then the system will move away from that fixed point. But then computing the second derivative, we found that indeed it's a stable fixed point, such that the RG flows are towards the stable fixed point. So basically, then our conclusion is that in the low energy limit, it does flow to a stable non-Fermi liquids fixed point. And I told you that the bare coupling is not marginal at DC, but this effective coupling is marginal at DC. And that's why we are allowed to make expansions in terms of this effective coupling rather than the bare coupling. So then by doing all these things, we are able to approach the interacting fixed point perturbatively within this range where aim lies between 1 and 2, although the bare coupling had a positive scaling dimension in this range. Okay, so we also computed higher loop diagrams, for example, two loop boson self energy. And we found that for m greater than 1, the answer is k suppressed. So the kf is in the denominator. The first part is actually similar to what you get for the one loop. The factors are similar to what you get for the one loop. But then you get an extra factor, which is kf suppressed. As I told you, kf is like an infinite scale in the theory. And therefore, the answer is 0, basically, for m greater than 1. But for m equal to 1, the answer is finite. There is no such kf suppression. And there is a UV finite correction. Now let us come to the two loop fermion self energy. Here also for m greater than 1, we saw the answer was kf suppressed. Now I didn't write down the expression because it's too big, but it's the same as we got for the boson, that the kf appears in the denominator where you take kf to infinity and the answer goes to 0. Again, for m equal to 1, there is a UV divergent answer. That means for m equal to 1, the loop calculation does not become one loop exact. So you have to correct it loop by loop. Anyway, so the conclusion from this generic observation is that for the m greater than 1 case, everything is one loop exact and the higher order corrections basically vanish.
So is this just verified at two loops or is it true?
It is verified only at two loops. I mean, of course, I cannot compute for higher loops, but from the generic structure of the loop calculations that we saw, we had a generic prediction that this will hold for higher loops as well, because this 1/kf comes from certain loop integrals. And you can see that, well, if you go to higher and higher loops, there will be more powers of kf coming in the bottom.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So the next, actually, how much time do I have? Do I have enough time? Because
feel free to take your time.
Okay. So the next thing that I will discuss will be the pairing instabilities of such critical Fermi surface state. So what we want to ask is the following. We know that a generic Fermi liquid is unstable to arbitrary weak negative interactions in the BCS channel, leading to Kupac pairing. But now we want to ask the question, what about critical Fermi surface? What is their behavior? What critical value of this negative interaction do you require? So this is the question we wanted to answer. Now there was a work by Metlitsky, Senthil, and other people who studied this question But for 2 plus 1D non-Fermi liquids, they considered both isognematic kind of order parameter as well as the gauge filled part. But they use this formalism where they modify the boson dispersion. And again, let me remind you that formalism breaks locality in real space. I had an earlier work in this area, but that was not a controlled approximation. We did a very simple-minded Hartree-Fock mean field solution of the self-consistent gap equation for Fermi surface coupled to U1 gauge field, and that was in 3 plus 1D. But now, since we have discovered this tool of dimensional regularization, we wanted to apply it for the isognematic scenario, which would include a generic M-dimensional Fermi surface. And as you know, that in our formalism, we do not break locality in real space. Okay, so to study the superconducting instability, we have to add the relevant four fermion terms. And for simplicity, we just consider the S-wave case where you just need at least two flavors. You can consider D-wave or higher order superconductivity, but those will be just computationally a little bit more involved, but we can get the intuitive answer just by considering the simplest case involving the S-wave pairing. So I've written it in terms of the two component spin-on that I showed you in the beginning of the technical details, but if you expand it out, then you can immediately recognize the BCS coupling terms. Okay, so these are the Feynman diagrams that I considered up to this one loop order. And then we just went ahead and computed the various answers for these loops. This allowed me to compute the beta functions for the VS. So the VS is actually the coupling constant here for the four fermion interaction. And I found that the scatterings in the pairing channel are enhanced again by a certain factor of the volume of the Fermi surface, which is kf to the power m by 2. Just as you saw for the Yukawa coupling, the effective coupling in this case that dictates potential instability is not quite the Baer coupling, but the Baer coupling multiplied with this kf tilde to the power m by 2. Now, this is the this effective coupling becomes marginal at codimension d minus m equal to 1, where this superconducting instability appears. Now, our aim is to study how the presence of the E effective coupling affects the pairing stability. Now, I mean, as we know that there can be pairing stability in the absence of E effective, but how the presence of E effective modifies the conclusions that we find there. Okay, so just to show you how the beta function looks like, so you see that if I write down the beta function for Vs tilde, we have these first two terms, which you will also derive for a normal Fermi liquid, for a normal BCS pairing. But now, since we have this E effective, we have these two other extra terms, which will modify the beta function. Basically, if you set E effective equal to 0, you get the same conclusion for a Fermi liquid, but now we have this two extra terms to consider. So we solve our beta function, including these two extra terms. And I will show you the results. So basically, I see that whether I find a solution for Vs tilde. So wherever you have these colored regions, that means there is a finite solution for the Vs tilde. But where you have these white regions, it just means that there is no finite solution. So basically, there are two solutions for Vs tilde because it's a quadratic equation. You have Vs tilde square, and that's why I have plotted the two solutions and try to see that how the RG flow goes, or what is the value of the critical, what can be the critical value of Vs tilde to get a pairing state. This becomes clear when we actually plot the RG flows. So we find that both for m equal to 1 and m equal to 2, it does not matter wherever you start from, you always end up with a superconducting state. Okay, so this is the difference from what we have for an ordinary Fermi liquid. Just let me remind you, for an ordinary Fermi liquid, you get pairing for any negative value of the Vs tilde. But here we see that even if we start with a positive value of Vs tilde, it is susceptible to superconducting instability. So it is more susceptible to pairing compared to an ordinary Fermi liquid system. And that's why the quantum critical point is always hidden by a superconducting dome. Okay, so now let me just review my recent work involving transverse cage fields, which is why Liu Jun got interested in my work. So I'll just tell you very briefly about it. It's similar to what we did with the Ising pneumatic case, but in this case, we have a Fermi surface interacting with the transverse U1 gauge field. Now we have almost the same action that I had before. Now I'm denoting the gauge field by A, as you can see in the second line. And then the last line involves the coupling between the gauge field and the fermions. Now there is a subtle difference, or a very clear difference actually. The coupling, the interaction vertex of the coupling for the Ising pneumatic case involved I gamma d minus m, but here it involves gamma zero. And gamma zero is one of the component of this vector matrix gamma, capital gamma. So the computation is a little bit different because it becomes a little bit more cumbersome. But finally, the values of DC and the critical exponents are the same as we found for the Ising pneumatic case. Okay, so my main aim was to consider two fermion flavors, which is very much related to Liu Jun's recent work, where they considered two gauge fields, AC and AS. So that is like a U1 cross U1 theory. So you need at least two fermions. The first fermion carries the same charge under the gauge fields, under both the gauge fields, AC and AS. And the second fermion carries equal and opposite charges under these two gauge fields. And they used this model to explain the quantum phase transition between a mod insulator to a metal, or a metal to metal phase transition, where you have Fermi surfaces of different shapes on the two sides of the quantum phase transition. So this is the motivation for considering this particular model. And they found a very curious thing that when they computed the RG flow, it flowed to a fixed line rather than a fixed point. So in my framework, I also found the same. Let me just point out that Liu Jun and Debanjan did this computation by that same method that Senthil and Shankar used, that is modifying the dispersion of the boson. But I just redid this using the dimensional regularization framework that we had used for the Ising pneumatic case. And I found that from my calculation also, I found this fixed line feature. Now, Liu Jun and Debanjan, they computed it for a one-dimensional Fermi surface, and my formalism allowed me to compute it even for a two-dimensional formalism. And I found that this feature holds for m greater than or equal to 1, as well as for the generic loop arguments that we had. Okay, so let me just summarize. So we performed, or we described an RG analysis for a critical Fermi surface state. And in that way, we could explain the scaling behavior of such states in a controlled approximation. So we could apply it to an m-dimensional Fermi surface by extending its co-dimension to a generic value. In that way, we could identify stable non-Fermi liquid fixed points using the small parameter epsilon, which is the difference between the critical dimension and the physical dimension. So this served as the perturbative control parameter in our calculations. We also showed how to calculate the pairing instability as a function of dimension and co-dimension of the Fermi surface. And the conclusion was that the superconductivity must always mask the quantum critical point. Now, one of the key points that we should remember is that the scale kf enters as a dimensionful parameter whenever m is greater than 1, which is unlike in any relativistic QFT where you don't have an extra dimensional parameter entering into the scaling arguments. So we have to be careful before using any naive scaling argument to see that whether kf is making any difference there. And we also observed that we must consider the effective coupling constants, which were controlling the loop expansion and not the bare coupling constant. And these were some combinations of the effective coupling and the scale kf. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Okay, thanks for the talk. Any questions?
Yeah, so when you said the line of critical points survive even at higher loop, is this the case for m equal 1, or only for M.
Yeah, so basically the calculations were very hard, so I did not compute the values explicitly. So basically I don't know the values of say U1, U2, etc. But I saw what diagrams will contribute, and then I tried to write down the generic beta function, and I found that it should always be something which will give you this EC tilde plus ES tilde equal to constant. That is for M equal to 1, right? And for M greater than 1, we already know they are suppressed. But for M equal to 1, I just drew the diagrams which will come into the picture without computing the exact coefficients. And then I plugged it into the generic RG equation or this beta function equation that you have, just pretending that there are some values, say V1, V2, etc. And now I solve it. Then I found that it's the same as what you get for the 1 loop.
So are you saying that there's some general argument that protects the line of fixed point? Is that?
Okay, for I don't know what the generic argument is or if there is a generic symmetry which protects it. But if you just see the nature of the diagrams, you will always see that it comes in this combination. Like in the first loop, it comes in the combination EC plus ES. In the two loop case, all the diagrams will contribute something which will be in the combination EC plus ES whole square. But by just seeing that what kind of loops or what kind of lines that you can draw.
Uh-huh. So
yeah,
you're saying up to some loop, it only appears in this combination.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can imagine in a higher loop, maybe EC and ES may appear separately.
But how will that, I fail to see that in the sense that ES and EC have exactly similar coupling with the fermions. So you have to invent a diagram.
So one such quantum question might be, if I have one kind of fermion loop interacting with the gauge boson many times, there the gauge coupling appears in one particular combination. Right,
but then you have to be careful that what line that contracts with. So if that line is allowed to contract with two different kind of fermions, then I agree with you. But if that line is allowed to contract with only one kind of fermion, then you will not get that kind of a diagram.
Yeah, but you can have a many fermion loop where the boson can contract with a different fermion loop. Right.
Okay,
simplest one is probably this Larkin diagram.
Okay, so I will have to see that if I did not consider maybe that one. Okay. So my argument was for the two loop. I just drew all the diagrams for the two loop, and there I did not see how you can actually get line with two different fermions.
Yeah, so, I think this kind of appears first in the three loop.
Okay,
thank you.
I also have another question. Previously, you mentioned one of the disadvantages of this dimensional regularization is the breaking of U1 symmetry. I'm a bit concerned about it. There are a couple of points. First, previously I was asking about the Lodo line in three dimensions. It's a one-dimensional Fermi surface in three-dimensional space. There, the system has an exact U1 symmetry. But you said in this dimensional regularization scheme, you do not have the U1 symmetry. Then it appears to me that the family of theories which you consider by changing the co-dimension do not contain the case of Lodo line.
I think my argument in that case was that I didn't see where I was using the U1 symmetry because I never used U1 symmetry to derive anything. So it was not useful in giving any particular result. So that's why I just thought, okay, I'll just blindly compute the loop. There is a U1 symmetry, sure, but what physical observable is it breaking by not considering the U1 symmetry? I didn't find anything which was in contradiction with breaking with the U1 symmetry. So I thought that maybe it is not that big of a problem that we do it in the intermediate states. I don't know, like Sangsik might have more intuition about it.
Sangsik, you are muted.
So in this formalism, the global U1 is broken by as Ipsita explained, turning on some p-wave pairing that leaves only the nodal line gapless and then other parts of the higher dimensional Fermi surface gapped. So then I think Lujun's concern probably is that without the U1 symmetry, the mass of the gauge boson is not protected anymore. They will be generally Higgsed. And I think to reach the theory that Ipsita is studying, probably one needs to fine-tune those mass of the gauge boson. So physically speaking, you are in the superconducting state. So generically, without fine-tuning, those gauge boson will be gapped. But you can still fine-tune those gauge boson to be massless. It's like if you fine-tune, you can have a gapless gauge boson within a superconductor. And then I think Ipsita is studying that theory. And then one can ask how this theory kind of is related to the original physical theory. And probably it's continuously related because as epsilon goes to 1/2, the U1 symmetry is restored. So probably this U1 symmetry breaking effect will become smaller and smaller as you approach physical dimension, I think, yeah.
But I had one concern, which probably I thought, I didn't know whom to ask. I think Lujun told me that he had some word identity related sudden correction to sudden correction. But here sort of I didn't use any such thing, or if I was supposed to get any word identity, one had preserved the U1 symmetry. That part was not
right. So yeah, that's right. So you no longer have those word identity, and but as again as epsilon the and then there will be some discrepancy between vertex correction and self-energy correction in general, but those effects will go to zero as epsilon approaches 1/2.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but one can ask how this theory is closely related to the original theory. I think it's not ideal. Ideally, one would like to have the full symmetry, but I don't think we have such scheme at the moment.
Yeah, and also I think ideally one would just not consider the transverse part also. I mean, it's a gauge theory, so what happens to the other parts? So you should have included those parts also, and then you're fixing the gauge. Those gauge fixing parts should also appear in the action. I don't know if those are irrelevant, that's why you're throwing them out, or a complete theory should consider those things also, no?
Yeah, but I think as a physical theory, it's a legal theory. It's an emergible theory that is, yeah.
For the gauge field where we only consider transverse part, the usual argument is just the finite density of fermions screen first screens the A zero part, and then we just look at the spatial part. We then would just take the Coulomb gauge. So here about the applicability of this dimensional regularization scheme to U1 gauge theory, Sansik, please correct me if I'm wrong. I guess what Sansik is saying is at the physical dimension where epsilon is equal to 1/2, the U1 symmetry breaking effect is gone. Although in the entire path coming from epsilon equal to zero to epsilon equal to 1/2, in the process, in the middle of the process, the U1 symmetry breaking effect is there. Is this what you mean?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So at epsilon equal to 1/2, the U1 symmetry breaking effect is gone. How is this known?
Because that's the original theory by design.
Epsilon equal to 1/2? Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so when epsilon is equal to 1/2, then d minus m is.
So this is for m equal 1. the one dimensional forming surface, and then as Ipsita said, critical dimension is 5/2. The spatial dimension is 5/2, and then.
So when you say epsilon equal to 1/2, you mean the spatial dimension is 2.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So at least the answer should be continuous as a function of epsilon. But for epsilon not equals to 1/2, some features of the physical theory will be lost, like some scaling dimension is no longer protected, those kind of things.
Mm. What about pairing instability? If you break the U1 symmetry from the start, then you already have pairing from the beginning.
Well, you are already in the superconducting state with a P-wave pairing. Then you can study some secondary superconducting instability that gaps out the remaining line node, that like S-wave pairing instability.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this other pairing that I talked about is the pairing of the original Fermi surface. So even if you are considering a cylinder, that's the line, that's the pairing of the line node on the cylinder.
Okay. Then suppose I talk about the case where the Fermi surface is two-dimensional and the space is three-dimensional.
Right.
In this case, if I do not use dimension, in this case, the quantum corrections will be logarithmic. I can either use dimensional regularization or other regularization schemes. Suppose I use dimensional regularization scheme, then I will, in principle, still have the problem that the U1 symmetry is only restored at the physical dimension. Is it right?
For d equal to 3, the physical dimension and the critical dimension are the same, actually.
Yeah. But if you want to do some regular dimensional regularization, you still have to tune away from the critical upper critical dimension to a lower dimension, right? So that the integrals are convergent.
Right. So it's just the epsilon where epsilon goes to zero at the end. That's actually zero at the end, actually, for the three-dimensional case.
Yeah. So, but still, when epsilon is non-zero in the middle of the process, the U1 symmetry is still broken.
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking is because actually I think this 3D case may be very much worth studying at the moment, even compared to the 2+1D case.
And why do you think so? I mean, experimentally, why the 3D case is interesting, I really don't know.
In 3D, there are some heavy fermion materials I think that was the first experiment where one saw where the Fermi surface can have an abrupt change. This is a one experimental motivation. And also, there's also some conceptual motivation. For example, if we consider the confinement transition of a 3+1D U1 gauge theory, basically, so far, there's not much continuous confinement transition unless you have a very large flavor symmetry where the number of flavor is 300 or something. But now you can consider possible continuous transition from a Fermi nuclear to a U1 gauge theory. And the mechanism is just to have two Fermi surfaces in 3D, each coupled to a U1 gauge field, and then use the mechanism generalize the mechanism we study in 2D to 3D. In one side, if you condense the boson, you have Fermi nuclear. In the other side, you gap out the boson. If there's pairing instability, one of the U1 will be Higgs, and you have a remaining U1. So you can possibly have a transition from a Fermi nuclear to a U1 quantum spin nuclear in 3D. That's quite interesting, I think.
Also in
that case, there's some simplification because in 3D, as you just said, there's no fixed line, but just a fixed point. The special property of this theory would be, in that case, would be the ratio of the two gauge couplings will still be arch-invariant, at least to some order of calculations. Then I think in this case, one can just use the leading or sub-leading results of the beta functions to make predictions. This is very different from the 2+1D case where you have a fixed line to start with, and then you have to go to some higher order such that you flip the fixed line into a couple of fixed points, or you have to prove to all orders of calculations the fixed line just survives. But in 3D, it's a bit simplified.
Yeah, okay, so then that will be a good motivation to do that pairing calculation for the 3D, I guess.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments?
So I have another question. So Isita, you mentioned this quantum critical point between metal to FFLO, superconducting state. And you said potentially this critical point have no other instability.
Well, that's because we considered some other competing instabilities which can appear, and try to see if that is more like, yeah, if that can overpower the following. The ones that we considered, it didn't seem that it will overpower, except probably the CDW, which had the same dimension as this one. So that's why the conclusion was it's potentially, sorry, I didn't let you finish your question.
So and then in this critical point, at this critical point, is it the case that only those points connected by Q vector actually lose the coherence? Yeah. Then other parts of the Fermi surface is...
Yeah, it's not a hot Fermi surface. It's just the hot spots.
I see. Okay. But you're saying other parts of the Fermi surface doesn't have BCS instability because of the mismatch.
It's just the QFFLO thing which is connecting the
points. I see. Okay. Thank you.
But do you have to assume the FFLO wave vector is commensurate with something?
No, you just take the FFLO order parameter and couple it with the fermions that you have. It's like writing a mean field theory. You write like delta C dagger C, right? So in this case, it will be delta submatrix C dagger C or whatever we had, some complicated thing.
But if the wave vector is incommensurate, wouldn't you connect many pieces on the Fermi surface? Will you move it?
In that sense, yes. So we are assuming that there is only one QFFLO value and it's connecting the two different points of the Fermi surface. Well, the effective theory includes which are the points that you're already connecting. But for us, it's only a finite number of points that is connecting. As you're saying, if it's like maybe irrational, then it will connect an infinite number of points. But that's not what we considered.
Okay, thanks.
And maybe one more question. So I remember we discussed about this before, but I'm asking again. So in the study of superconductivity, you included the three-level diagram of the four-fermion coupling mediated by the critical boson, right?
Right.
This is not. So you're not doing recent energy. So and this is not one PI diagram. So so usually we don't include those three level effects, right?
Right. So I mean, like alternatively, you remember we were changing the language between one loop and lambda. So you can have the 1/ε as lambda. But for the three level, so that was the confusion from the beginning where the project got stuck, right? But then I saw what Sohn and other people were doing. Basically, when you consider the beta functions, you have to decompose it into angular momentum channels. So basically that divergence come when you decompose that three-level diagram into angular momentum channels, then an extra integral comes into play and that gives you a pole there.
Yeah, so I see how that arises in the, say, Wilsonian momentum shell like RG, where you integrate out some high momentum bosonic mode, and then this bosonic mode mediates some four-forming coupling at some point separated by the boson momentum. But in the field theoretic RG scheme that you are using, I think. Mm-hmm. The rule is that we compute the vortex function, which is the 1PI.
Yeah.
One particle irreducible diagrams, and then they are the, and then we only add counter term for those things. But in the end, the physics should be same no matter what scheme you are using. But I think in one scheme you have to use one scheme consistently. I think. But do you have some?
Yeah, I really don't know then what is the answer to this question, because that part really I computed by saying that, okay, since there is a connection between the two, this we have to decompose by this channels, and then we'll compute it by using the lambda cutoff. But I don't think I know the relation, how to relate it to the fact that it violates the rule that you just consider only 1PI diagrams. I really don't know what's the answer to that. But unless you do that, it seems that the answer is also physically wrong, right? So that's the only justification I had.
The answer is physically wrong?
No, because you don't have a particular leading order term, which is this E V tilde, something like that, yeah.
Well, there is still the source term, right? There is still the ladder-like diagram, the one-loop diagram that source the four-forming coupling that has a similar effect, but at high order. So I guess...
That there is a line and then you have a loop?
There's a ladder diagram.
Okay, let me see. I think I considered that, or I don't remember.
Yeah, so I'm saying the source term will be still there. I guess it's not necessarily wrong to, the physical conclusion might not be necessarily wrong, even if you do not include a three-level diagram.
But my point is that maybe that diagram did not contribute, so I don't remember exactly. I have to look at my paper.
Well, it actually contributes. It's not log divergent. Probably that's your point, but it is actually IR divergent, and I think it contributes more singularly, I think.
So then that does not resolve the issue, right? I'm very confused now. So if I had considered that whatever you're calling as the ladder diagram, and that does not have the UV, then that will also not contribute to the beta function.
Actually, it does, because although it's not log divergent, it has the IR divergence. So,
and even if it has R divergence, it will.
So you know, it's like in FIFO theory in three dimension, you don't have UV divergence, right? It's a super renormalizable theory. But still,
Let me confirm with you which diagram we are talking about, because maybe I don't know what is the ladder diagram. So is this the diagram that you are talking about?
No. The with two fermion line connected by two boson lines.
It's none of this.
None of those. Yeah. So two parallel fermion line connected by two boson line, like ladder.
Oh, I see. So it's there are two horizontal fermion lines, and there are two vertical boson lines.
Right.
They look like a rectangle, except the external legs are fermions.
That's right. And that will give the source to the four-fermion coupling from boson.
Okay, that's somehow I had in my notes. I remember, but I don't know what was the answer of that. Okay, then I have to go back and check it.
Hmm. Okay, yeah.
Speaking of whether you should include the tree-level diagram, I guess we discussed before, maybe this depends on what you mean by V in the beta function. If you, by V, you mean the 1PI vortex function, then you don't include that tree-level diagram. If by V,
that's right.
in the four-point correlation function of the fermions that you included.
That's right, yeah. And what you mean by V is determined by what scheme you are using. And
also in Liujun's calculation, they don't have this E square Vs tilde, which I somehow have. So it doesn't make a difference, but I'm just saying that...
We don't have what?
Okay, let me just see this thing. So if you look at the beta function, I had two terms. One was proportional to E effective, and another was proportional to E effective Vs tilde. I think you did not have one of these terms.
We didn't write down the E effective times V tilde term in the main text because it's high order. We wrote it in the appendix, in the last appendix, almost the last equation.
Okay, and why is it higher order? Because it's the same order as Vs tilde square, no?
It's higher order in the sense that in that scheme,
in your scheme it is because you have like this two powers of E probably, yeah, okay.
Maybe let me finish this. In that scheme, maybe it's fair to say it started from something, changing the, perhaps Nyack-Weierstrass, it changes the kinetic term of the gauge field from k squared to k to 1 plus epsilon. And then suppose the beta function eventually takes the form that has three terms. One is ES, the other is ES times V, as you said, and the other is V squared.
Mm.
So with these three terms, if I just look at the ES, E, the term E, and the term V squared, then the value of the fixed point is of order of square root of epsilon. Now, then the E times V will be of order epsilon to the power of 3/2. Then in this sense, this term is high order.
Okay. But for me, I think it's of the same order as my other terms. So then is it like a discrepancy of using the two different schemes?
I'm not sure. So for you, the fixed point value of E is still epsilon, right? I think if you solve it order by order, I think there's also a sense where you can say E times V is higher order than the other two terms.
Well, that's the confusion because I also have the V square in my terms. So I thought I should consider this term as well to keep everything at the same order.
So if all of the three terms are of the same order, that means the value of V for you will be of order epsilon.
It's not exactly epsilon, but there is another parameter, gamma epsilon. So it's a bit complicated because the two critical dimensions don't match. So the critical dimension for the superconducting instability is not the same as the critical dimension of the Yukawa coupling. Generically speaking, it matches for three dimension, but not for the two dimensional case.
Will this bring in some new problem?
Well, for me, then the beta function solving was a little bit problematic because I had to expand it in two parameters, etc. And then, I don't remember the exact technical details, but since it was not matching for the m equal to 1 case, it was not so straightforward.
I see. What I was just saying is if both the epsilons are the same epsilon, then you want to say the three terms are of the same order, then because E at the fixed point is of order epsilon, then eventually you want to say the fixed point value of V is also of order epsilon. Then this fixed point value is larger than the, it is smaller than the fixed point value of square root of epsilon.
I really don't know because I never solved this equation by hand. I just did the numerical plots.
Mm-hmm.
since it was a bit complicated, as I said, for generic M and D. So I never tried to solve it in that way that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.